And yes, we do live from the NASDAQ market site overlooking the world famous New York Times Square. This is the world famous Fast Money. Hi, everybody. I am Brian Sullivan in for Melissa Lee. And your traders on the desk tonight are Brian Kelly, Mark Tepper, Karen Feinerman, and Guy Adami. Tonight on Fast, the man moves markets. JP Morgan's Marco Kalanovich says there is a, quote, extraordinary opportunity in the market right now. And he's going to tell you where it is straight ahead. Plus, the great divergence. Why oil stocks are going down while oil prices are going up. Could this be the one group you must invest in next year? And a New Year's resolution for Potbelly CFO, why the sandwich chain lost more than just 6% today. So there is a lot to do, and we will get to it all. But let us begin now with the Federal Reserve. As expected, no change in rates in the final meeting of both the year and the final meeting, guys, of the decade.
Come on.
But that's all in the past, guys. What should we expect in the future, in the new year? A rate cut? A rate hike? Steve Leishman was there. He was asking questions at the press conference, and he joins us now with more. Good evening, Steve.
Sully, thanks. The Federal Reserve ended a momentous year for monetary policy by launching what it indicated was a new regime. One where policy is likely to remain on hold for what could be at least several months. The move to neutral follows three successive rate cuts that began in August and a reversal of plans to hike earlier this year. Now in the policy statement following the December meeting, the Fed called its current stance of policy appropriate. The Fed's overnight lending rate now standing at a range of 1.5% to 1.75%, and Fed Chair Jerome Powell saying that could be the case for a while to come.
We believe that the current stance of monetary policy will support sustained growth, a strong labor market, and inflation near our symmetric 2% objective. As long as incoming information about the economy remains broadly consistent with this outlook, the current stance of monetary policy likely will remain appropriate.
The statement said the Fed is monitoring global developments. That means it has its eye on the trade war and on foreign economic weakness in both China and Europe. While the chairman didn't rule out future rate cuts, he suggested the bar for hiking is high, as in high inflation. Powell said policy not on a preset course, but one sign rates could be on hold for a while. 13 of the 17 members of the Fed forecast no change in rates for next year, Brian. So you tell me, is that risk on or risk off?
Well, I can't, but I know our traders can. I want to ask you one more question, though, Steve, because we do get a change next year. I mean, you got some voting members out. You got some new voting members in because they rotate every year. How you know all the personalities. How much change or dissent or debate do you think that's going to bring with it in the new year?
You know, what's interesting this year we found, Brian, is that doves became hawks and hawks stayed where they were and some people moved to the center. People aren't necessarily ingrained where they are. I think only one, Esther George, remained on the kind of hawkish end. Mester moved towards the center. She was hawkish. I mean, I got to wait to see what the policy is to know where people are going to stand. But one thing we do know, which I think is a development worth talking about, is that I think Powell has control of this committee. This is policy that he supports, and the committee is not in a place that, A, he doesn't support, and, B, that he didn't lead it to. And I think he's engineered. Let's talk about what happened. We went from planned rate hikes to, well, now we're going to cut, to three cuts to now on hold. All of that in a 12-month period. It's well to remember this time last year we had a 3% 10-year and we had a forecast from the Fed itself that the funds rate would be 3% at the end of this year. Instead, cut it in half, 1.5%.
All right, Steve Leishman in D.C. No, it's been a long day for you, buddy. We appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right, so with the Fed kind of seemingly out of the way for a while, what does it mean for stocks? We head into next year, Guy Adami, and also how much of this year's pretty spectacular gains have been Fed-induced?
This year?
This
how about
year?
The last 8-9 years
I said
Fed-induced?
This
year, I would say most of it, if not all of it. I mean, it's clearly not on earnings growth because you don't really have a lot of earnings growth. You don't have a lot of revenue growth. It's a lot on stock buybacks and the market's belief that somehow magically the Fed has their back. You know, I find it somewhat interesting that Paul Volcker passed away this week and basically around the same time that the Fed lost any remaining semblance of credibility they ever had. And I don't want to get up on a soapbox, but, you know, the Fed talks about inflation. They measure inflation, everything ex inflation, because if they really factored in inflation, it would far surpass any benchmark they had. But to answer your question, I mean, the market seems to want to go higher. I still think President Trump is going to pull the ripcord on these tariffs on Saturday night, because in his mind, the Chinese are weak, they're vulnerable, the stock market's at an all-time high. I can step on their neck, might cost me a month or so in the market, but by, you know, February, March, I can turn this thing around, sets up well for the election.
Yeah.
So if you're hoping that things don't happen this weekend, I'm not convinced they won't.
Look, go ahead.
Well, that's the risk of this market, and I was surprised that the stock market wasn't higher today because you asked what's the impact on this. The Federal Reserve has had a very tough time, almost impossible time, creating the type of inflation that they want. But they're excellent at creating asset inflation. So that should be great for the stock market. So after today's reaction and they're telling you, hey, we're going to run the economy hotter, we want more inflation, you would think that equities would be much higher. But I think there's this trade war, trade tariff risk hanging over the market.
Why would anybody buy stocks this week, Karen, when you've got not only the Sunday potential tariffs, which we're going to get to more with Kayla, because Peter Navarro, the trade guy in the Trump administration, wants to go ahead with the tariffs. You've got this election in the UK tomorrow as well, which could determine, again, the fate of Brexit. There's so much risk out there. Why put more risk on?
If you feel like there's a little bit of risk priced in for tariffs, right? I don't think people think there's zero risk of the tariffs being in place on Sunday. So I think there's that. And also, we've sort of managed to earn through tariffs. The market's higher. Even with, we had tariffs this summer. We had tariffs in May. So ultimately, the market has been higher. I'm nervous. I think the VIX is up. I think that's telling you that people are nervous. 15, it hasn't been hovering around 15 for a while. So I'm long and nervous and have protection.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot more downside risk right now than upside potential. So I'm nervous as well. I think there's nothing wrong with holding cash. I see no reason to put cash to work prior to next Monday. We need to see what happens here, right? I mean, in my opinion, tariffs either get delayed or they come into effect on December 15th. There's not going to be a deal, right? When we talk about the Fed did a great job this year, right? 25%, the stock market's up this year, the S&P 500. But my concern is how much of 2020's performance did we pull forward into 2019? So now what should
answer
we expect
your own
next
question,
year?
Mark.
5-6% maybe? I mean, mid-single digits? I think a lot of the upside of next year has already been pulled forward. The Fed's off the table, so now what do you need to focus on? You need to focus on volatility surrounding the election. You need to focus on a trade deal. When is it actually going to go into effect if we get one? And you need to focus on the consumer, because the consumer's been the workhorse of this economy.
Well, let's bring in somebody maybe that can answer all those questions.
There we go.
We added a gentleman on the set, a well-known guy, Marco Kalanovich. He is the global head of macro quantitative and derivative strategy for J.P. Morgan Chase. So first to Mark's question, Marco, thank you, which is, have we stolen next year's gains this year?
No, I don't think so. Actually, if you look at the market performance last 2 years, I think market is up maybe 5% since January 2018. So if it was not for this rally last month, we would have been basically down 2 years. Russell would be down. S&P would be basically X of utilities and bond proxies would be down. So I don't think we stole anything. I think people say that we had a record rally this year. They don't say that in the last quarter we had the worst quarter sort of since 1929, which just bounced back in the first quarter, and basically market was exactly flat where it was like a sort of 18 months before that. So I don't think we stole anything. I mean, certainly last month we had this a bit of a melt up. You said that sort of why would you deploy cash now before all these catalysts? So that means that many people probably think that way. So I think there is some upside. I don't think we stole anything. Some of it is certainly priced in. I mean, we had a good Fed and a little bit of Brexit positive.
You remain fairly optimistic, not wildly bullish. You're not screaming
Correct.
Pounding the table, but you think the markets, the equity markets as a whole, will probably go up again next year a little bit.
Yes, we think it's going to go up a little bit when you look at when you talk about S&P, and S&P is basically has stuff which is expensive and has stuff which is cheap. We think it's going to be a bit of rotation, but globally sort of equities outside of US, we think they can go higher. So if you look at emerging market, if you look at Japan, even Europe, and then specifically some of the sort of cyclical sectors, we have quite a bit of a space.
So the Fed, since I think it was September 17th mm-hmm. or 11th or something, when overnight rates spiked to 10%. I mean, they've increased their balance sheet faster over the last couple months than they've done, I think, over the last 10 years. What's going on? I mean, what do they see that the rest of us don't see? Because there's nothing normal about what they're calling normal.
So certainly we have a slowdown globally in manufacturing as driven by the trade war. Still, there is a lot of political uncertainty, and not just coming from U.S., but other parts of the U.S. They see that. I think they probably also recognize that they did over-tighten in the second half of last year, specifically in December. I know Powell was saying that they would probably do the same thing, but December was the worst month since 1907 for various asset classes. If you hike in that environment, I think they're a bit over-tightened. So I think they're sort of adjusting it back because of trade war. I think the uncertainty is prompting central banks around the world to cut. So actually, if you look at the right now, number of central banks that are cutting versus hiking is near record. You know, so we do have something which looks a little bit like a synchronized monetary easing globally.
So, Mark, I think I read your notes. You had a 34.50 target, I think, for the end of next year. Do you get there on earnings growth, multiple? How do you get there?
So it's 34, and basically we do have a bit positive view on earnings on 180 and EPS on S&P. That does assume that some of the tariffs will be rolled back, you know, September. So the dialogue so far has been basically Chinese want some rollback of the tariffs. U.S. wants some concession on purchases and other stuff. So we think that some progress will be made, which will include some partial rollback of the tariffs. So that's why we're a little bit optimistic on the EPS. You know, so as you said, that's why we're not really pounding the table for 3,400. But we do think sort of central bank easing, PMI is turning around globally. We think sort of cyclicals can catch up to defensives, value can catch up to momentum and growth, and high beta stocks can catch up to sort of quality stocks. So that's sort of the view.
So, Mark, I'm curious, is this kind of a first half view, and do things change as we approach the election?
So it is certainly a first half view because seasonally you do have these type of moves happening typically early in the year. And if we do get this phase one, I think that will be the catalyst for this. Second half of the year could become a little bit more tricky, but we nonetheless think that sort of the U.S. elections are not going to be the massive risk. We don't see big probability of sort of progressive left or extreme left candidate. So we see it sort of more as a match of Trump versus maybe centrist.
But if the risk might be doing nothing, and, mm-hmm. and I wish I'd asked for a chart of this. If you look at the markets for about a year and a half before the 2016 election, mm-hmm. the markets did nothing.
Yeah.
It did nothing. People literally for 15 months just kind of sat there and watched the election and wondered what happened because there was such a gross disparity between the two candidates. We have huge disparity now between some of the positions. And I do wonder, Marco, that if you're an investor, mm-hmm. you've made a pretty good amount of money over the last decade, Fed-induced or not, Guy Adami,
you know, yeah.
why not just sort of sit out and wait?
So, I can see your point. You know, I would just say that we do have a sort of Trump who wants to get reelected, and he knows that reelection chances are somewhat related to the fate of the market, you know, and he has some bullets to spend specifically on the trade. Basically, I think he can sort of put up some breaks out of the market to help his reelection prospects. So that could be one element, you know. Again, I would go back and you say if you made a lot of money in the last 2 years, I'm not sure everybody made a lot of money in 2 years. Like, we had a very big swing, you know, from September to this. 10 years for sure, yeah.
The last 10 years,
but
yeah.
But since, you know, since sort of last 2 years, you know, a lot of people were buying high,
flat,
selling low,
flat-ish, and you yeah, mistimed it. Yeah.
So, we will certainly monitor election probabilities, how they evolve. Right now, we're not concerned as much about the left, far left candidate. If that sort of starts coming back in a game, we will probably turn a bit more cautious.
Well, if and when you do that, let us know, and we will get you back on one of the shows, right, BK?
I think so.
Marco Kalanovich, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good stuff. Mark Tepper.
Yep.
You're out there what they call them swing states.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want you to get political, but Ohio, mm-hmm. where you're from, a very important state. Any way to sort of read it vis-a-vis the markets?
To read it vis-a-vis the markets. As far as the state of Ohio goes, I mean, you know, you got a bunch of blue-collar people working their butts off trying to save as much money as they can. And what's happening there is they are very happy their portfolios have gone up, but at the same point in time, they're very, very skeptical of what next year brings ahead for us, right? I mean, they're concerned about the election. I mean, that's first and foremost, right? The election and trade are probably the number one and number two concerns that I hear from my clients in Ohio.
And you wonder, Guy Adami, if we get close and it looks like it's going to be Trump versus a centrist or maybe a Mayor Pete or a Michael Bloomberg, you know, although Bloomberg's chances are minuscule, we get that. If it looks like the momentum is going more on the sort of progressive side, sort of more the taxing side, Do you think we get a move?
I think, well, if it's more centrist, and if obviously President Trump is the Republican candidate, I think that's market positive on the margins for sure. But, you know, these are stories that are going to play themselves out in the spring of next year.
Yeah,
it's hard to game it now. And I understand what everybody's saying, and I understand sometimes you got to make this easy. And the easy thing is just ride the wave of the market. I get it, but the warning signs are there. Newmont Mining, for example, first time it's closed above $40, I think, in the last 4 years or so. The gold market is trying to tell you something. The yield curve's flattening out again. I mean, all those things are out there. Nobody cares until they do. And I'm telling you something, that repo market stuff, which everybody says is not a big deal.
Don't
it's
say
temporary.
Everybody, my friend. I've talked about it.
Fair enough.
You know,
I shouldn't
point say where
everybody.
People say, why do you keep bringing it up?
Because it's a big deal.
There's nothing wrong with it. And if there was nothing wrong, now it's happened before. This is not, it has happened before. But it is unusual.
It's more than unusual.
This year's different, too, because of Basel III, though. The Basel III rules come in this year, so you haven't seen bank balance sheets be constrained like this. So there is a difference year end.
It's the bloodstream of the market.
Yeah.
Fair to say?
And you, what's that medicine you need to keep the blood flowing? I don't want to get into great detail here, but that's what's going on.
What is that medicine?
I have no idea.
What's the medicine, guy?
I don't know.
All right. We are following developing story on the trade talks. And this one is one of the more unusual ones we've had on in the last couple of days or weeks. Kayla Tausche in D.C. with the latest on, I don't know what to call it, Kayla.
Well, Brian, for the last few days, various members of the Trump administration have been sounding off on trade ahead of this December 15th deadline. But the resident White House hawk, Peter Navarro, is leaning on his fictional alter ego, which he calls Ron Vera, to disseminate a case that tariffs are good and a phase one deal is bad. In an email memo circulated on Monday, December 9th, obtained by CNBC and first reported by the New York Times, Ron Vera makes this contrarian argument that, quote, tariffs are working to defend economy and have had no negative impacts on growth or stock market rise. They spur growth by improving net exports. And he also suggests the White House, quote, get uncertainty out of the market by announcing no deal until after the election and ride the tariffs to victory. It's unclear why Navarro wanted these talking points out there, especially under the stage name of Ron Vera, and how widely he circulated this memo, the authenticity of which he confirmed to the New York Times. We reached out to Navarro and the White House for comment. Navarro himself has been arguing upstream against this phase one deal since it was announced, Brian, but certainly now he's taking his case over email and sending out these arguments as his alter ego, Ron Vera, instead.
Some sort of jumbled up anagram of his last name, obviously. I mean, do we?
Right.
Does he have another one? Is there like a third one, Kayla, that you know of?
So far as we know, Ron Vera is the one that he leans on the most. He came under fire for this back in October when an Australian scholar realized that this character, Ron Vera, was appearing in many of Navarro's books and that he couldn't find this expert cited elsewhere. Navarro said it was an open secret, that it was essentially an inside joke that had spilled out into the open. But even after coming under fire for that and criticizing journalists for using their own anonymous sources, why Navarro chose to lean on this identity again to disseminate this case is really perplexing.
A lot of perplexing turns. Kayla Tausche, thank you very much for that interesting story. You could do the anagram on his first name and call it Tepper.
Yeah.
It's close. Anybody got anything on this?
I don't understand why he didn't use his name, right?
Yeah, you have a powerful position. By the way, you're one of the most powerful people in the government. And you're advocating a very strong position on something you have said publicly many times.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's like Guy Adami writing about the repo market problems under some Adamus.
So what was the best picture in 1991? I'll spare you the Google search.
Big.
It was Silence of the Lambs. Oh, remember, Hannibal Lecter was a fan of anagrams as well. Lewis Friend.
Benjamin Rassbill lived in Baltimore, but he may have lied.
So maybe Pete Navarro is watching too many Jodie Foster movies, because that is as lame as it gets. And I know he watches the show. Lame.
Lame. There you go. Male anagram. All right. Earlier today, we heard from investor Jeff Gundlach. Here's what he had to say about any kind of a trade deal.
I've been consistently stating that there will be no trade deal until the 2020 election. There's absolutely no reason for China to do a trade deal on the terms that the United States wants when there's an election coming up in less than a year, and potentially they could have somebody else that is more old school and wants the genie back in the bottle and would take the tariffs away.
BK?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you.
He's in there nodding. I assumed you had something to say.
You know what I've been nodding about is there's somebody on this desk who said this for about a year and a half. His name's Guy Adami. He has said consistently that you will not have any trade deal until after the election. And I think you have to, at least as an investor, plan for that now. I mean, we came with this phase one, which came out of nowhere. I don't see a lot of incentive, except for perhaps a weakening Chinese economy. That might be the catalyst to get them closer to the line. But it's, you know, we're a year away from the president saying we're getting close.
Guy's getting a lot of love, well-deserved tonight.
True.
I love you.
All right. And number two, what Gundlach also said was that he had read some white paper, whatever, that basically the phase one deal, he called it phase point one because it wasn't like we're going to make a deal for you to buy soybeans. It's we're going to make a deal for you to maybe buy soybeans somewhere in the next few years. That even if there was a deal, it's nothing.
It's, right. I think there is an argument to be made for some certainty, though. Right?
It's a step in the right direction.
Exactly.
I do think there's going to be a deal, though. I mean, if you think about it, President Trump's approval rating.
A global deal or a small
deal. Something has to get done because President Trump's approval rating is directly correlated to any progress on the trade front. And as we near that election, I think he's got to get a deal done. China doesn't have as much incentive, right? So that's the issue.
Maybe we just keep the tariffs at this level for the rest forever, right? I mean, Chinese, their currency has gone down. Some of their suppliers are eating it. We're eating it a little bit. Consumer keeps chugging along. We'll see. All right, coming up.
That's Ron's point.
Yep. Sales up, stock down. Kind of sums up Lululemon right now, but it's been one heck of a moneymaker year for investors. We're going to dive into Lulu, and then perhaps the most confusing market story this year. Oil up, oil stocks way down, plus a stat that will blow your collective minds. As always, we are live from the New York Times Square. And there is so much fast money right after this. Ben. All right, welcome back to Fast Money. There is an earnings alert on Lululemon and shares of the retailer. They're down about 4.5% right now. And after hours, the back of those results, let's get to Meg Terrell back at CNBC HQ, who apparently has changed her beat. She's now covering retail. Meg, we appreciate it.
Just yoga pants, Brian. And by all descriptions, of course, this was a good quarter for Lululemon, a beat on both the top and bottom lines, as well as comparable sales that came in ahead of estimates. Now, the company's Q4 guidance was slightly light of what Wall Street was looking for, and analysts point out the stock's almost doubled year-to-date, perhaps describing why some is coming off in the after hours. Now, there's been, of course, a lot of focus on Lulu's men's offerings, CEO Calvin McDonald highlighting their contribution, among others, to growth in the quarter on the conference call just now.
Momentum continues in our pant category, and both men's and women's comps outperforming the overall chain. In addition, we continue to expand the key categories of bras and outerwear, with comps and outerwear being particularly strong. And in men's, I'm proud that we increased our revenue 38% this quarter, which is the largest increase of the year.
And Lulu has laid out goals to double its men's business and its digital business and quadruple internationally by 2023. McDonald saying the company will double its store base in China this year, telling analysts the company is, quote, only scratching the surface in China and Asia overall. He also took a moment to comment on the situation in Hong Kong, noting that they're monitoring events there closely and they've seen a minimal impact on the overall business. But note it's been offset, guys, overall by the strength in the region. Brian, back to you.
All right, Meg Terrell. Meg, thank you very much. Karen, 57 times trailing earnings. Stocks basically doubled this year.
I know. There was nothing wrong with this earnings. Just, you know,
it was pretty good.
Yeah. It was pretty good
price
for anybody else.
It has to be great.
Yes. Well, and it was up $3 during the day. So it's only down net, like, you know, 3%. I think, you know, expectations are just too high. If you look at the chart, it's been a rocket ship. I think pulling back $7 isn't enough. That's I'd want a, you know, more of a discount to buy it here. But I don't know. It's just such impressive results when you consider the rest of the retail landscape. Okay. They're just crushing it.
All right. For more on Lululemon's results, you can head over to CNBC.com. Meantime, here's what else is happening on the television.
Saudi Aramco made big waves when it hit the markets in Riyadh. But how does it affect the market for U.S. energy stocks? And later, pot stocks have burned through a quarter of their collective market cap this year. Will they light up again? Those stories and more when Fast Money returns.
All right, welcome back to Fast Money. Some pretty big news crossing within the last hour in the energy space. Long time Continental Resources CEO Harold Hamm will be stepping down. He's going to remain at the company, though, however, as executive chairman, but not the CEO. Stock largely unchanged in the after hours on CLR, staying with energy. All right, let's show the celebration that happened overnight when Saudi Aramco made its long-awaited market debut in Riyadh. Reason to bell. There you go. There was reason to celebrate as well. Shares rose 10%. By the way, that's the daily limit, as much as they could, in their first day of trading. And that move gave Aramco a market value of,
bell,
sit down or stand up, nearly $1.9 trillion.
Stop.
That's $700 billion more than the valuation of Apple. But that's nothing. Take a look at this chart, okay? Saudi Aramco's market cap is now bigger by about $500 million than all the publicly traded U.S. oil and gas companies combined. Together, every oil and gas company is about $1.5 trillion, Karen, and Aramco's nearly two. Of course, we know that Saudi Arabia wanted an even higher valuation than what it got. Is one company, is one of those stats, every company combined in American oil and gas, 204 of them, are worth $500 billion less than Aramco? Is one of those mispriced, Karen?
Or maybe both. I mean, maybe U.S. oil companies altogether, collectively, should be trading higher. That is,
by the way, that includes Exxon, Chevron. It's not just the little guys, because the market cap's been crushed by debt. That's the problem.
Right. So, I mean, if you're bullish and there's debt, then the U.S. oil companies, you would think, would outperform, right, relative to Saudi Aramco.
I mean, this is, what, 4% of the S&P 500 now, the energy sector? I think in 2008 it might have been 13%. So it's, you've seen the market cap of these companies shrink relative to the S&P. And the energy sector overall has been a place since mid-2014 that you sent your money to die, right? I mean, the S&P has generated a total return since mid-2014 of positive 76-ish percent. Mm-hmm. And the XLE is down 30% over that same time frame.
A decade of gains.
Right, exactly. So, you know, I think this is a...
Do you own any of them, Mark? Any reason to own any of them?
I own Kinder Morgan. It's the only one I own.
Just taking that
dividend. Got a 5% yield, right? I mean, you got heavy insider buying.
What about Enterprise Transfer Partners? Basically a Kinder Morgan clone, but trades at half the valuation. Some people would argue just because KMI, Kinder Morgan's in the S&P 500, and ETP is not.
Yeah, we prefer Kinder Morgan. Huge insider buying. We like their exposure to the Permian. They're getting paid to move stuff, so... Yep. We like them. That's
all right. What we prefer. Well, Aramco's explosive IPO is a standalone in a sea of red for energy. Really, it's obviously, as Mark just said, worst performing sector of the year, worst performing of the decade. And check this out, though. This is unusual. A very interesting divergence is happening. This is crude oil versus the XOP, one of the bigger energy oil and gas ETFs. The XOP is down 20% this year. Crude oil, though, is up 30% this year. Normally, they trade together. Not so this year. Let's find out where this may go and get off the charts with Mark Newton of Newton Advisors. Mark.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, it's still difficult to make a case for buying energy here. I know it's fashionable as you get into end of the year to think, okay, mean reversion, the sector has to snap back just because it's oversold. But you see the persistent downtrend that's been in place in XOP, down 20% this year, down over 50% from last September. So in order to at least have a little bit of hope, you really need to get up over $22. But really, anything down under this would suggest that you could actually fall into the mid-teens. And so it's important to really put the charts into perspective and the price action. You look at a longer-term chart just going back since 2016 where crude bottomed, and this is substantial. This is also right down near current levels. And actually, prices now are under this level. So anything under 20, and I would argue that this actually can still go lower. You know, if we see signs of crude breaking out above 60, the production cuts, if Iraq falls through and actually starts to cut as planned, if demand comes back, crude starts to move up, I think we can see a bounce in energy. I just don't see much technically that would suggest that it's there just yet. The downtrend has been very persistent. With that in mind, there are a few stocks that I would suggest that can be bought here. And I think you really have to be selective. Until we see that mean reversion snap back, it's tough to buy the laggards. You really have to stick with the stocks that have been strong. Phillips 66 is one of these. It's had a pretty persistent uptrend over the last 6 to 8 months of this year. I know it's not a long time. Last September was where these former highs were. Now it's pulled back over the last few weeks, right to a level that I actually like buying into this. So former highs should represent support. 105 to 110, you can buy this. Think that it gets back to these highs near 123. The other one I like is ConocoPhillips. Okay, this also has shown some recent signs of actually improving of late. You've actually snapped this one-year downtrend. The stock is actually performing relatively better. You know, if anything, it's a classic case of needing to be selective in this sector. Everybody wants to look at the Schlumbergers and the Halliburtons. Of course, the XLE has the rich dividend names, but, you know, in general, energy's been a tough place. And until we see signs of this snapping back, technically, you need to see a little bit of evidence.
So
still proper to avoid it.
Mark, are Conoco and PSX, Phillips, are those good-looking charts, or are they just the best-looking charts in the terrible neighborhood of energy?
I would argue that both of these are some that you can buy. But, yes, within energy, these are really ones that that stand out. I mean, PSX would be one that I would personally put money to work, 105 to 110. And, really, I would take a look at Conoco as well. But, you know, you have to have tight stops in a group like energy where, you know, any sign of failure, obviously, with the production cuts and you start to see, you know, crude sell back off. And if anything, you know, that could affect this sector. So it's just been a difficult trade.
Yeah, it really has. Debt, $654 total billion dollars in gross debt across this space on $71 billion in net income, Guy Adami.
You know the space cold, Brian.
I like
Sullivan. I mean, if the TV thing doesn't work out for you, I'm not suggesting that it won't.
Well, 22 years later.
I mean, you could be in the energy space. You'd be killing. You have the look for it.
Midland wearing overalls and a hat. Oh, I've done that.
By the way, PSX, major double bottom at 83.5, and the chart just illustrated that. But you know what? This 122 level that we just failed at, that's where we topped out in August 2016. 105 is interesting. I actually think this trade's a little bit lower. You buy it, and not for any particular reason other than it's a 50% retracement,
yep.
Around $100 or so is where.
Okay, so as we talked about, debt is a huge story. Most of these companies have terrible credit ratings. They are junk or they are near junk, but there are six stocks out there that are currently rated as A or better by S&P. Mm. Ready? Here you go. Exxon, it's AAA. Chevron, Schlumberger, Halliburton, Baker Hughes, and EOG. Six with an A credit rating. That's it. Out of 204, well, about 150.
A lot of debt out there.
About 150 that are rated. Any of those you like?
So it's a longer-term play, but I like EOG. And it's not because it's oily. It's because it's gassy.
Best management team in oil and gas, says every single person I talk to.
And I think if you're thinking about what do you buy low, sell high, natural gas for the long term, next 3 to 5 years, you want to be in that space.
Okay. Thank you very much. Good discussion, Mark. Thank you. Fellow Hokie, by the way. All right. We are on Retail Watch. What to expect from Costco when they report their results tomorrow. And later, hot stocks, you know, they have been tough, gone up in smoke. But there could be some new green for the space of the new year. Green, the kind that you could make. We are headed to Sin City.
Come on.
To talk. Yeah, we are, Guy. Not literally. We're going to do it on television, so we'll stay here. Fast Money is back in two. Let's take a look now at our Cramer Cam. Now, Jim tonight is speaking with the CEO of cybersecurity company Palo Alto Networks, PANW. You got to catch that full interview, of course. That's coming up at the top of the hour. Jim, Mad Money, 6 p.m. Eastern. We're back in 2 minutes. All right, welcome back. A retail sweetheart of the market is suddenly slumping just a bit. Mm. Costco stumbling, tripping, sliding, whatever you want to say. In tomorrow's earnings report, it's down about 2% since mid-November. Not a disaster, but it's not up. But over in the options market, traders say that betting against Costco could cost you.
Mm.
See what we did there? Danielle Shea of SimplerTrading.com joins us now to break down all the options action. Danielle, welcome. What are you seeing in the options market of Costco?
So looking at the options market of Costco, right now we're seeing a sizzle of about 2.5 times calls versus put buyers. I think that's interesting, especially because, you know, we have Costco that's up 45% year to date, almost twice that in the S&P. And so for me, I feel like that is what is causing retail traders to be so bullish going into this earnings report. However, normally Costco trades lower after earnings.
So when you look at that options imbalance, would you call it an imbalance first off, the 2.5 times?
Yes, I would call it an imbalance. I'm not seeing really unusual options activity just because the activity is spread across a variety of strikes. It just seems to me a bullish slant.
It is a bullish slant on Costco. We could see there's the implied versus sort of the average.
Yes.
You know, around the desk, and we'll come back to Danielle as well. Costco, you know, this has been a good stock until recently, Karen.
Mm-hmm.
You want to dip back in on any kind of weakness, or do you think that the run is done? You've made your money.
Well, just kind of looking at what you're saying, it would seem to me 3% volatility versus 4 average, you wouldn't be a seller of that straddle for tomorrow. You'd rather be a buyer, it sounds like.
Well, you know, honestly, for me,
one way or the other.
Well, honestly, for me, I would rather wait until after the report, because the last 6 out of 8 quarters, it traded lower and then proceeded to rally to a new all-time high. So I would actually rather not trade the report and wait and buy the dip.
So really, the idea is don't take some big betting position into Costco hoping you're going to get some miracle on 5-pound tubs of mayonnaise.
Well, potentially. But, I mean, if you look at the range, actually, I mean, you have a range between about 0.5% and 8.5% move. So you could potentially go with the straddle. But 4 of the last 8 quarters, it barely moved. So for that reason, I wouldn't stick with the straddle. What do you think, Guy?
I think she's on to something. Now, the last 4 quarters, it's vacillated between up, down. Last quarter was down 9%. The quarter before was up 5%. Stands to reason this is a quarter that it can rally. People are scared of valuation, but you know what? The stock has been impervious to that. So I'm on Danielle's team. And you know what the definition of wishful thinking? You should go into Costco this weekend and check it out. It's the 80-year-old couple that goes in and buys like 40 rolls of toilet paper. I love that. It's fantastic. I mean, really. If I get to that point, which I probably won't, I'm just buying it by the roll. You know what I'm saying? Just saying. It's a lot of fun, Costco.
So what you're saying is buy Kimberly-Clark into the...
That's your hedge.
Into the clothes.
That's your hedge.
Is what you're saying. That were short Kimberly-Clark, I guess, under Guy's doomsday scenario. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Very much, Danielle. Thank you very much. I'm sorry about...
You're not sorry.
I'm sorry. All right, for more options action, tune into our live show every Friday, 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. All right, up next, we're going to be talking pot stocks with who else? Jane Wells at this year's largest marijuana business conference out in Las Vegas. You did a pot retail giant store, which is awesome. Now you're at a pot conference. Jane Wells, man, you're just flying.
Okay, I mean, it beats working for a living. The buzz here, see what I did, is that will 2020 be any better than the awful year 2019 was? When we come back, the good, the bad, and the Christian, when Fast Money returns.
All right, and welcome back. Well, POC stocks, they've been taking a hit this year with names like Tilray down more than 70%. But despite talks in the industry bubble maybe bursting, some investors are still lighting into the space. We're going to get to Jane Wells at this year's largest marijuana business conference, which, of course, is in Las Vegas. Jane.
Hey, Brian, let me show you the good and the bad. First, the good. Some companies are doing well, like Planet 13 Holdings. They own the largest legal marijuana store in the world. They are cash flow positive. They have 3,000 customers a day. All right, the bad, how the big publicly traded companies have fared as the legal business model, even in Canada, just isn't rolling out as quickly as expected. A veteran investor, Danny Moses, says expect more or some M&A next year. See these companies issue new stock to try to gin up more cash. And he says be a little cautious about this rush into hemp and the whole CBD craze.
And I think one of the things in the CBD market that still remains to be seen is, is it really CBD in the product? And I think as you test some products that are out there, I would imagine you're going to find that there's not, whether that's intentional or not, but that's a whole nother thing down the road. But consumers should pay attention to that.
Now, meantime, it's the biggest MJ BizCon ever, over 35,000 people, and you never know who you're going to run into here. I mean, they let anyone in here.
I think a little bit of a reality check. Year over year, we were in such a different place last year. It was Dutch Flowers. And I think the promise of 2019 is probably not the baseline for 2020, but I think build off of that for investors because you've actually shaken out a lot of dead wood.
And finally, just in time for Christmas, cannabis for Christians. As entrepreneurs search for new markets, here's a new one. A guy who used to be the head of original programming at MTV has a bunch of new cannabis ventures, including God's Greenery.
What we found is that there's this wave of Christians that really view CBD as God's gift of healing as they look at taking control of their health and wellness journey.
Okay, up next, no lie, he says he's been approached about kosher cannabis. Ryan?
Kosher cannabis. Okay, I like it. Jane, here's a quick question. Is there any actual pot at the Marijuana Business Conference?
No, you can't have it in here. Actually, we saw a drug-sniffing dog here this morning at
How'd
a pot conference. Let me give you an idea, though. Well, he came up empty. Look at these plants back here. So since you can't bring actual marijuana in here, when they show off the growing products, they have to bring in regular garden plants to do it. So, yeah, no pot in here. Smelled a little of it outside, but nothing inside.
Very interesting. I can't imagine that
drug-sniffing
dog.
But not in here.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a little bit busy. I mean, just people walking. Who knows? Jane Wells, thank you very much. Great stuff. All right, so we should note, you just saw Tim Seymour. And, of course, as you know, he's all in on cannabis. You can read all of his disclosures on our website. All right, what is your take on the pot stocks heading into next year, BK?
They actually look somewhat interesting to me. I think, you know, to the point that you had this big bubble and then it's now bust, and you're starting to see some of the kind of the froth go out of it. You look at something like a Canopy Growth and how that has traded recently, starts to tell me that maybe some investors are taking shots here. The issue you have, obviously, is they're not earning money quite yet, and the regulatory change has taken a lot longer than I expected. But if you're looking to get into the space for the longer term, I think a Canopy Growth at these levels is not a bad place to dip your toe in.
So I think after a 70-ish percent pullback, valuations are much more reasonable right now. So I tend to like the multi-state operators. So Green Thumb is my favorite in
the
space.
You're still talking about not most states. I mean, what is
correct.
It? 16, I think it's legal in a the number may be off, but you're not buying a product that is legally available in most states.
Correct. Yeah. So, I mean, Green Thumb, they operate in 12 states right now. They've got over 100 licenses. They're only utilizing 25-ish of those licenses, so they can easily quadruple revenues over the next few years without additional legalization. Of the 12 states they're in, 5 to 6 are likely going to be approved for full adult use over the next 2 years, so I think there's pretty good potential there.
Okay, there you go. So if that last story is leaving you with a case of the munchies, perhaps, up next we're going to talk Potbelly and how this is an interesting story. One of their executives is leaving to go to a gym company. Potbelly to a gym company. You can't make it up. We're going to explain when Fast Money returns. Real story. All right, welcome back to Fast Money. Is your New Year's resolution fewer sandwiches and more gym? Well, you might not be alone. Kind of. Potbelly CFO Tom Fitzgerald is leaving the company to join the Planet Fitness management team. So in classic Fast Money fashion, would you rather Potbelly guy or Planet Fitness?
Every day of the week, Planet Fitness. We are a nation now of people that are, they live a lifestyle that's not particularly healthy. Get your rear ends into the gym, folks. Get out of the Potbelly. I'm sure it's excellent sandwiches. And get into that Planet Fitness, by the way, which is up from $55 to current levels. Big valuation, but I think it makes a push towards the $80 level that we saw a year or so ago. To answer your question, Planet Fitness.
Yeah, so I agree. I agree. Planet Fitness as well. I mean, we really like the whole health and wellness theme over the course of the next decade. Obviously, Potbelly doesn't fit. Planet Fitness does. The issue I have with Planet Fitness is it is expensive, but I do like the subscription-based recurring revenue.
Yeah, I like how BK and I are sucking in our guts. Yeah. Pepper's all skinny. So we're like, hey, I can't talk because I'm sucking it in so much. All right, it is time now for our final trade. Let's go around the horn, BK. Burger King,
yes.
What's up?
So listen, Fed today said they want higher inflation. If you think the bond market has it wrong, then you buy TBT, short bonds. Mm.
Mark?
Broadcom, been bullish on it for a while. Semis are breaking out. Broadcom's going to follow. It's a relative value play here.
Okay, Broadcom. Karen?
Yes, I like Ulta. I think, you know, still have growth at a reasonable price. I know it took a hit recently, but not a hit. What jumped up recently, but then pulled back a little bit. I like Ulta.
Okay, Guy Dom.
You're a large, tall man. You're not, you're perfect.
If I was a garanimal, I'd be like the rhino or whatever that is, the hippo.
Hippo. Are there hippos?
Honey badger.
You know, Newmont Mining, by the way, is at levels we haven't seen, as I mentioned, NEM.
Yep, gotta go. See you tomorrow.